coming up on Tech Nation, emotional agility, what it is, how we can use it, and what science tells us about how it actually works. Dr. Susan David, a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, joins me to talk about evidence-based psychology. Then on Biotech Nation, we go beyond familiar approaches to creating drugs and look at an approach that uses that part of the immune system called siRNA. Quark Pharmaceuticals is working on treatments for kidney damage following open-heart surgery. Damage to kidneys during the transplantation process, as well as sudden vision loss. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
My mother's voice rings in my ears. Just because everyone says it's true doesn't mean it is. I actually remember her tossing this over her shoulder while she was hastily stirring homemade pea soup in Grandma's famous pot and frenetically trying to get dinner on the table for everyone in very short order. Pretty good advice from someone who was otherwise totally engaged. I haven't thought about it much until recently, when untruths, shall we say, became a part of the presidential election. Given the ability to trace facts is a relatively simple matter, given access to the internet and a careful set of rules to qualify the source of any data, then yes, every fact a candidate offers can be traced and quantified. It turns out that's no longer relevant to a lot of people, at least not yet. In a speech at the National Press Club, global entrepreneur Peter Thiel looked at it this way. Trump voters took him seriously, but not literally, while non-Trump voters took him literally, but not seriously. So being literally correct on the facts just wasn't important, at least in this time, in this place. But it also means that social media, journalism, education, and the truth, and trust, are having a very bad shock. Let's start with social media, and let's go back to Mom. Just because everyone says it's true doesn't mean it is. We thought we were past the days where anyone can say anything, and apparently we're not. The loudest voice in the neighborhood was one thing. The loudest voice on the planet is another. And there was a kernel of an assumption in social media that the fact that people swarming to a source lends a credibility to that source. Well, yes, credibility, but not truth. It's not a fact. It's a quote. And social media is looking at what they're doing. Facebook is on a campaign to eliminate what it calls fake news, while BuzzFeed noted that nearly 90% of the fake news stories were pro-Trump or anti-Clinton. It's a whole new level for a computer to tell the difference between a fact and a non-fact, shall we say. It's just data. And when it comes down to a popularity contest between statements, well, that's just not good enough. Does that mean that Google is responsible solely for what people think, as in voting with their internet clicks, or for the truth? Even Wikipedia has for some time implemented policies to counteract the inclusion of disinformation, a bellwether that the entirety of social media could be gamed. This leaves us with journalism and education. And journalists and teachers have a lot more in common than you might think. They hate reporting and/or teaching on truths, because no matter what they say, many people come away remembering the untruths as true. We humans don't have a tag on every fact in our brains which says true or false. We make everything we remember pretty much true, while our memories are notoriously fickle. Repeatedly recalling events can erode the recollection. One memory merges with another. Details of traumatic events are encoded on many levels, and the consumption of daily media in our modern age, it leaves impressions and data residue. Just like we hear what we want to hear, we remember what we want to remember. We're at a whole new place in human history, which shall change us forever forward. It's the nexus of truth and trust. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Dr. Susan David, a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and author of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Then on Biotech Nation, using a more recently discovered part of our immune system, siRNA, to treat the effects of kidney damage following open-heart surgery, damage sustained during the transplantation process, and sudden vision loss. I asked Dr. Susan David, the author of Emotional Agility, to start out with what science can tell us about humans and their emotions.
Well, what science tells us is that while there's so much in the external world that we try to control and manage, that ultimately how we deal with our emotions and our inner world is absolutely crucial to the way we live, the way we lead, our ability to sustain and maintain health behaviors, and our ability to be effective in our lives. And so how we navigate and deal with our internal world is crucial to our lifelong well-being, our success, and our ability to be effective in the world that we live.
Now, anyone who's been through a stressful situation, a difficult meeting at work, I mean, a family meeting with a big decision, everybody hates those, you know, you go through all sorts of emotions. Obviously, the experience of emotions is a dynamic over time.
Absolutely. And one of the core predictors of people who are effective with their emotions is the ability to recognize that emotions are transient, that emotions change, that there is no need for our emotions to drive our decision-making and our actions, but by the same token, that underneath our emotions, our sense of sadness, our guilt, our anxiety, there are often clues, beacons to things that we care about and value. So what's really critical from an emotions perspective is to appreciate that while we live in a culture that tells us that happiness is absolutely the priority, that we really only get resilient and effective when we develop a skill set that enables us to be with all of our emotions in a way that recognizes that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. And this appreciation that emotions change and they have value is key to our ability to bring ourselves forward effectively.
And you said something in there that I think people have to understand is that you only feel sort of one emotion at a time. Sometimes one emotion leads to another. I remember one psychologist, a guest on the program, said if you have jealousy, it kind of slips away into anger. You know, so if you're angry about something in some situations, like, gee, was I really jealous? You know, it's like analyzing your emotions and where you are. It's really important. You're maybe bouncing between a couple of emotions going on there.
Yes, and this is critical. We often are raised in families and even in a society that tells us that some emotions are okay to be felt and some emotions are not okay. So psychologists call this display rules. This idea of boys don't cry or we don't do sadness here, maybe even with the best of intentions because we feel uncomfortable with seeing our children sad, we might try to make things right. And yet what we really appreciate from an emotions perspective and a psychological perspective is that the ability to hold and analyze and be with all of our emotions is so important. When we are only okay with some emotions and not others, what we can start doing is start losing the value that emotions bring. And also, we can fail to develop some key skill sets that you referenced earlier. So, for example, a lot of times people will come home from work and say, I'm stressed. And then the next day, how was your day? I'm stressed. There is a world of difference between, for example, being able to understand and label stress versus anger, stress versus sadness, stress versus frustration, disappointment, betrayal, stress versus I thought that I would be in a very different point in my life right now. And what we know from the research is that the ability to label emotions in a more nuanced and differentiated way is actually key to our ability to then problem solve around that emotion, develop strategies, learn from the emotion. And that only comes from firstly being open to accepting of the emotion, which is not the same as blind resignation, and labeling and trying to really get to the core of what our emotion is trying to communicate.
I really responded to that sense of nuance in a situation. It's like the family rules. You might not be able to express certain emotions. You might. And then I thought about in my family growing up, there was my grandmother, my father, and my mother. And my grandmother, you could have any emotion around her and you could tell her and you could, you know, that was just the way it was. My father had lots of emotions, but he could never speak them. So you had this sort of osmosis about, gee, what is he feeling? And you could kind of get there, I guess. But we did the best we could. And then my mother, you'd better not have an emotion. We have no time for emotions here. So that even when you look at your family system, it's nuanced. It's there's, you know, gee, well, it matters whether dad's come home from work or not, stressed or otherwise. It matters. And I think it affects it because we are used to living in systems of emotions where everyone has a set of rules.
Yes. And over time, what we start to do is we start to, from that dynamic system, develop our own set of rules. So often people will, for example, have rules around, is it okay to feel sad or not? Is anger okay? Or do I need to leave the room when there is conflict? And these kinds of rules can be very, very constraining to our lifelong health and well-being, because what it can mean is that the rule that you had when you were growing up as a child, and you knew that when dad was in a particular mood to maybe avoid that situation, and might even have been a functional, effective rule in that situation because it helped you to sustain and develop a family dynamic that was healthy. What can happen over time is when you then apply that same rule of when there's conflict, let me leave, can maybe not work so well or serve you in a relationship in which it's really important to be able, in which it's really important to be able to have an effective, rich, deep conversation with someone that you actually care about, and in which conflict might be part of that. So we grow up with these rules. Sometimes these rules over time fail to serve us any longer.
One example that I've seen is that I would get angry about something, not, you know, just you're correctly angry about something, not, and just a person next to me would think I was angry at them. It's like, I'm not angry at you. Didn't you just see what happened there? You know, and it's like, it was so real for them that if there was anger in the room, it had to be pointed at them. Now, let's go to the workplace. Somebody gets angry about something, they're going to think they're angry at them. Totally undermines what they could possibly do, how they can proceed.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what happens is we start developing the signs of what I call emotional inagility or emotional rigidity, where our thoughts, our emotions, our behaviors start to be driven by how we feel at the time. So, for example, someone is angry, they're angry at me, therefore I'm just going to shut down. Or I'm having the experience of anxiety in this meeting, I feel like a fraud, therefore I must be a fraud, I'm just going to keep quiet. And what starts to happen is our emotions then start to drive our action as opposed to our intention and our values and who we want to be in our relationship or in the workplace. Who's in charge? The thinker or the thought? Who's in charge? This emotion or me, who is big enough and capacious enough to experience all of my emotions? And being healthy with our emotions is fundamentally and at core, first and foremost, about being able to be open to the emotional world, to be accepting of and not struggle with emotions, and be able to bring our values into the situation that we face.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Susan David, a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. Dr. David is co-founder and co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital in Boston and CEO of Evidence-Based Psychology. Her concept, emotional agility, was named Management Idea of the Year by Harvard Business Review. She's here today with emotional agility. Get unstuck, embrace change, and thrive in work and life. Well, let's go to emotional agility. You identify four different points that we need to consider.
So yes, fundamentally, when I was writing emotional agility, the core question that I was concerned with, that I was answering, is what does it take internally in the way we deal with our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories that help us to thrive in the world that we live in? Because what is so important is that our thoughts and our emotions and how we deal with these tend to actually drive almost every single aspect of our lives. How we parent, whether we're present or not, whether we can have an effective conversation, whether we put our hands up for a job. Every facet of our lives is driven ultimately by our relationship and our ability to be effective with our thoughts and our emotions. So the first part of emotional agility is what I call showing up. And what really underpins this idea is that we live in a world, apropos of what we spoke about earlier, where there are not only these display rules in our family about what emotions are okay or not okay, but really culturally, there is a view that is pervasive around happiness. We should be happy all the time.
Don't worry, be happy.
Don't worry, be happy. If you upset in the workplace or if you are feeling disaffected in your job, at least you've got a job. Think positive, push forward. Everything will be okay. What a friend of mine who died of stage 4 breast cancer called the tyranny of positivity. And what she said to me is, if it was just a case of being positive and that being happy and thinking happy would cure me of my breast cancer, all the people in my breast cancer support group would be alive today because they were the most positive people that I know. And what starts to happen in this culture of be positive is the tyranny of positivity takes me away from the authenticity of my experience, is what she said, that I am facing death. And when I'm constantly told by people that I need to be positive, it has two implications. First, it stops me from being real, having conversations that I need to have with my family and my loved ones. And secondly, it makes me feel culpable for my own death. That at some level, I wasn't positive enough. I wasn't able to think my way out of it. So don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-happiness. I have researched and investigated a lot around happiness. But what I think starts to happen in this idea of think happy, be happy is But what starts to happen in this culture of think happy, be happy is we, number one, know that people who set up happiness as a goal actually become less happy over time. Because happiness is not something that we aim for. It's not something that we should position as an expectation in our lives. Rather, it is a byproduct of exploring and living our values, of doing things that are intrinsically of meaning to us, and of bringing ourselves with presence and connectedness to our relationships and our work.
It's so amazing you say that, because I remember a time early in my graduate school career, boy, I was just working like the Dickens for a couple of years. And then, you know, it's like 2.5 years in, 3 years in, I realized, yeah, I got more work to do, but I know I'm going to get this PhD. I had it down. You know, this was, there we go. And within a few months, I just remember one day noticing that I was happy. It was, I had a nice place to live, I had a car, I had friends, I was working toward this goal, I had, you know, I just was happy, you know, and that was a noticing as opposed to trying. On the other hand, I've been through periods of my life which were very, you know, a lot of struggle in, and remember making a decision to go on a substantially different path, you know, not saying, oh, I was a chef and I'm going to be a heart surgeon. No, I mean, saying, no, we're not going here, because I realized I had spent perhaps the same amount of time not being happy. And it's like, it's a notice kind of thing as opposed to a goal.
This is critical. When we aim for happiness, when we read newspapers that tell us 5 things to be happy today, there are now a significant enough number of studies that show us that over time is completely paradoxically counterproductive. So this idea of being open to disaffection, being open to unhappiness, and noticing what that does and why it's so critical is twofold. First, when we try to be happy, what we are often doing is pushing aside disaffection. We are pushing aside anxiety. We're pushing aside sadness. We are effectively what I call bottling our emotions, where we are then closing ourselves off to the fundamental truth that underneath our emotions is often a signal or a signpost to things that we truly care about. I've never, in my work as a psychologist, met someone who is depressed, who isn't at some level concerned about how can I better be in this world. I've never met someone with social anxiety who isn't at some level concerned about how do I belong. A parent who is feeling guilty around their parenting, who isn't at some level concerned about, am I being effective here? Am I being present? Am I being enabling of my children? Or someone in the workplace who's angry with their idea being stolen, who isn't at some level concerned about issues of equity and fairness. So beneath our emotions, even the most difficult emotions, are signposts to things that we care about. It doesn't mean those emotions are right. It doesn't mean those emotions need to drive our action. But by being open to them, what we are then doing is creating space in our world for learning, for strategizing, for goal setting, for calibration, for bringing us closer to being who we most want to be.
One thing that I found fascinating here is that you're not talking to people to say, well, when this happens to you, then take this action to change the situation. You're simply looking at what is my emotional response. And so we gend up a bunch of cases. We call this kitchen research. I sit around the kitchen going, well, has this happened to you? Okay, we'll put this one. Everybody had a job at some point in their lives. So they were there. About what things you react to. And one person said that, what if your boss is someone who he or she thinks that they've made a mistake, somehow blames you, as in, I put that on you because, you know, which is ridiculous, you know, or you need to tell me these things. Like it never was, and you're not going to change the person talking to you. But she said she had a big reaction. She was blamed for something that wasn't her fault. There was no talking about it. He clearly didn't want to take, gave it away. It was a he, you know, didn't want to take responsibility. And it happened, you know, on a frequent enough basis that it was difficult. So she reacts. What should she do?
So critical here, again, is that this person is being triggered by a very specific patterned way of interactions in the workplace. So there's information in that, and that information is what is important to this person. Transparency, clarity, fairness. These are probably some of the values that will come up for this individual. And what that starts to signal to the person is this then, if I'm focusing on and opening myself up to this information, are these values that fundamentally are important enough for me to question whether they are being met or whether there is a good level of alignment in this particular workplace? So that's something first that I think is critical. The second thing from an emotional agility perspective is, so often people will say to me, but what happens if my boss really is an idiot? Or what happens if my coworker really is lazy? And one of the things that's really important is I describe this idea of being hooked. Being hooked is where your thoughts and your emotions and the stories that you tell yourself, this person is such and such, this is no good, I'm not going to put up with this, I'm trying to deploy immunization into third world countries, but there's no way that I'm going to let that government official talk to me in the way that my father used to talk to me. So what we're doing here is we are moving into the space where our thoughts and our emotions are calling the shots rather than how we truly want to be and what we want to bring of ourselves from an intentional values-based perspective to the workplace. So often what I'll be connecting with around here in this example that you give me is, one could come up with 1,000 different ways that your friend could respond to the situation. And every single response will likely be somewhat different.
I've been speaking with Harvard psychologist Dr. Susan David, the author of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, treating medical conditions of many types with a part of our immune system called siRNA. Quark Pharmaceuticals works on kidney damage following open heart surgery and as a result of transplantation and sudden vision loss. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Harvard Medical School psychologist, Dr. Susan David. Her book is Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. She said, I just want to make sure that I have an internal reaction when I see this, say, whether it's a little talk with myself or what would Dr. David say, who I was seeing the next day, what would Dr. David say when I'm in this situation? We know it's going to happen again. You know, 90% of the job is just great. Well, that's a pretty good percentage, you know, but every so often, this guy turns around and very specifically says something nonsensical as to why it is. Or, you know, he's reacting to something in his life, which is, you know, well, it can't be my fault or bad things will happen, you know. But she has to put up with it.
Yeah.
So how does she deal with that internally?
So really importantly, the first is being able to recognize that and to label it, which is the first critical skill set, which now starts to take this thing that can often feel difficult and hooky and driving of reactions into something that has circumscribed. I've named it, I've labeled it, I've recognized it, I've been able to discern what it is from my values-based perspective that actually rubs me up the wrong way. The second thing is starting to develop what I call stepping out. This is highly pragmatic. We've all experienced this. We phone our telephone service provider. They've got our bill wrong for the 1,000th time in the past 3 years. We finally get hold of a person and we are frothing at the mouth. And as we start to talk to this individual enraged, this voice goes off inside our minds that says, if you speak to this person really rudely, they'll conveniently lose your file or you will not get an outcome that serves you. This is called, from a psychological perspective, the ability to take a meta view, to helicopter above your thoughts and emotions. It doesn't mean that you're not angry. It doesn't mean that you're ignoring your thoughts and your emotions, but it means that you have the ability to observe them. Now, this is a critical skill set that people can cultivate. So, for example, with your friend, one of the things that is just a very small but powerful way that we can do this is to start noticing your thoughts and emotions for what they are. Thoughts and emotions, not directions. They are data. Data, not directions. So I'm noticing that I'm having the thought that I just want to yell at my boss. I'm noticing that I'm having the thought that I'm being undermined here. I'm noticing this feeling of anger. What you're starting to do in that situation is you are creating space between yourself and the thought and the emotion, so that the emotion is no longer 100% of you. So let me give you an example of this. If you say to someone, I am angry, this is so unfair, my boss treats me in this way, and I am angry. What you are doing in even that statement of I am angry is you are completely 100% conflating yourself and your anger. You, I am angry. When you start to even just preface, I'm noticing that I'm feeling angry, I'm noticing the urge to, I'm recognizing this in myself, you automatically start to helicopter above. Now, what's fundamental here is we start to get to this key question that I describe in emotional agility, which is, you may be right. Even if the gods of right came down and said, you are right and they are wrong. You are right and your boss is mistreating you. You still have a choice of how you want to be in that situation. You may choose to have the conversation. You may choose not to. But the important thing here is that it's driven not by immediate reactions, but by the capacity to recognize what's going on for yourself, to show up to those emotions, to create space then that allows you to insert the choice. And the most beautiful description of this, of course, comes from Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl, who survived the Nazi death camps, wrote, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose. And it is in that choice that comes our growth and freedom. When we are active and reactive, whether it's at work or at home, to our immediate thoughts and our emotions, there is no space between stimulus and response. We are hooked. Our emotions are driving us. But when we develop skills around stepping out, showing up, walking your why and moving on, these strategies and processes that I describe, what we enable is the breathing in and the bringing forward of intention and of values and of, is this serving me in the way that I want to be in my career, in the workplace, in the way that I parent, in my relationship?"
Let's put a big box around that. There is a space between you and your emotion. And the habit is to distance. You only need a half a second, a split second. You only need that. And to understand that they're separate. I mean, that's huge in and of itself. I want people to know that you have an emotional agility quiz out there. I took it. 5 minutes. Yeah, the results were great. It said no one has ever scored as high. No, I know you don't have that one. You don't have one like that, but it's out there at susandavid.com/learn. Let's talk about that emotional agility quiz in the know yourself category.
So what it is a couple of questions. It's a very brief quiz that basically is assessing how you deal with your own emotions. What are the set of relationships that you have with yourself? For example, do you bottle emotions, push them aside and try to pretend that they don't exist, often with good intention? I've just got this project that I've got to do, or I've got dinner to cook, but we push aside. Do we brood on our emotions? Do we analyze and overanalyze? Both of these look so different, are associated over time with lower levels of well-being, high levels of depression, high levels of anxiety. And what's really interesting is more difficulty in actually achieving the goal that you are trying to achieve, getting the project done or cooking the dinner. So the quiz assesses these types of capacities. It's very brief. It assesses things like our ability to be with ourselves in compassionate ways, which is critical in a world that would have us believe that we are in a never-ending Iron Man or Iron Woman competition, and that being compassionate is the same as being lazy or fooling ourselves. We know that this is not the case. We know that when people are compassionate about their failures, their setbacks, their difficulties, that they recover more from those and that they are more honest and more able to change effectively. So the quiz looks at these kinds of capacities. It's very short, and from it, people get a free 10-page PDF report around some of these skills.
It's fascinating. Fascinating to take. Fascinating to look at yourself. And of course, when you're on an airplane and they say, hey, you know, if we have a sudden loss of oxygen, please put the oxygen on yourself first and then take care of the children and the people around you. It's like, okay, first take your quiz. And then as a parent, how does that relate to taking care of your children? And you're going to see it in your parenting skills.
So important. We know, for example, that when people push aside emotions, I'm feeling stressed, but I'm just going to get on with it, that there's something that in psychology we call amplification or leakage, where you upset with your boss, you don't think about it, you push it aside, and then you disproportionately yell at your child for leaving a toy on the floor. So we know that there's this very important relationship between how we deal with our own emotions and also how we then model dealing with emotions to our children. You mentioned earlier the idea of being able to deal with our big emotions, that these emotions contain signposts and that we tend to have big emotions about things that we care about. The same with children. When we look at the data, by 2030, depression is targeted to be the leading cause of disability globally, outstripping cancer, outstripping heart disease. when we look at the increase in psychological ill health, suicide, and illness in children, it is devastating. And I truly believe that we need, as a society, because of the complexity and the challenges that our children will face, to help them more than anything deal with their tough emotions, to help them learn from their emotions, and to help them to navigate those emotions effectively. And that comes about first and foremost through being able to recognize this in ourselves, but also being able to be with our children's emotions and help them to label their emotions. As much as we, with good intentions, want to jump in and save them and make things right, what we do when we have that orientation to their emotions is we steal inadvertently, with good intentions, our ability of our children to learn. This is what sadness feels like. Sadness passes. Sadness is different from anger. Things that I do can help me to navigate the sadness. These are critical lifelong skills that help children to become more resilient.
Susan, fantastic. Please feel free. Come back anytime. We'd love to see you.
I would love to come back.
My guest today is Dr. Susan David. The book is Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. The Emotional Agility Quiz can be found at www.susandavid.com/learn. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we go beyond drugs, which create antibodies to attack bacteria and viruses in order to treat disease, to another approach to treating medical conditions of many types, this time enabling cells the time to heal themselves. We're talking about utilizing a more primitive part of our immune system discovered by science. It's siRNA. Quark Pharmaceuticals is using this science to treat such conditions as the effects of kidney damage following open heart surgery, as well as damage to kidneys in the transplantation process. 100,000 people are on the waiting list for transplanted kidneys. Some 20,000 kidneys are damaged in the transplantation exchange process. This is a critical need. This science can be explored for many conditions. Quark is also working in sudden vision loss, just a few of many treatment possibilities. Dr. Daniel Zur is the CEO of Quark Pharmaceuticals. I started by asking him, what's siRNA and what does it do?
siRNA is part of our innate immune system. It's a primitive, as you said. And what it does, it basically attacks the viruses or bacteria, which are made also from DNA or RNA, and it cuts the RNA of the virus and bacteria, and by doing so, basically kill them.
So it chop, 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 chop.
Chop, 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 yeah.
What do normal antibodies do when they encounter a bacteria?
It's engulf it, and then basically kill it by a different way. Okay.
But it's just a different way.
To get rid of it in a different way.
Now, we know that that's effective because we have any number of companies deliberately building antibodies to go after bacteria and viruses.
That's correct.
It's a big, big, big industry. But very few people now have started in this siRNA.
Antibody is a big industry, as you say. It's like $60 billion sales in last year. The problem with antibodies, they have to eat these viruses while the viruses or bacteria are outside the cell. They have no way to go inside the cell. The siRNA, this is small pieces of RNA, can go inside the cell. So potentially they can do much better job than the antibodies. One of the drawback of siRNA that you know you need to deliver it into the right organ or the right cells in the organ. While antibodies, they find themselves the way to the bacteria or to
the virus. They look all over the place, yeah, and if they encounter it, bang.
Now, one important thing to understand, we human beings, we develop the antibodies, and we are developing now the sRNA, not only to combat bacteria or viruses, but also to cure diseases. Because what you can do in case of antibodies, you can go and eat protein, for example, that is not good for us, or the body produces excess of it, and you need to get rid of it. So it is not just for combating diseases coming from bacteria or viruses, but also to cure all kinds of diseases. Same apply to siRNA. And the business of siRNA, since it goes into the cell, and the RNA, our RNA produced in the cell, it doesn't go outside the cell. It has potentially a bigger business than antibodies, potentially. Now, this was discovered only in the late 90s. It's a new discovery, and there are few companies that actually now developing drug based on siRNA. We are in the forefront of this business. We have two products already in phase three, which means that if we finish phase three successfully, it will be launched into the market. We are developing products for unmet medical needs, which means that there are no cure. And the beauty of it, that this potentially can cure almost any disease. Because you can go, all diseases that are based in our body are anyway connected to RNA, because all the protein produced from RNA. So if you know how to treat the RNA, you basically potentially can cure almost any disease. Potentially.
So DNA, RNA, protein. So if you can treat that RNA, you can affect the proteins. And
correct,
we're just big
correct.
Protein machines.
Yeah. We have two products that in phase three. We know how to deliver the siRNA into the kidney. We know how to deliver it into the eye and a few other organs, which I might mention later if we have time. Now, the kidney, what we are doing in the kidney, we are going to two diseases in the kidney. One disease, which is called acute kidney injury, is the result of open heart surgery, bypass operation, things like that.
And you have an injury to your kidney?
Yes. The major side effect in case of open heart surgery, when you do open heart surgery, the body is subjected to two short periods of ischemia.
And ischemia,
ischemia means hypoxia. Not enough oxygen reaches the body. You have to connect the body into a heart and lung machine. So it's a small period of time that there is not enough oxygen in the body. And then when you finish the operation and the heart resumes its own beating, then there is what is called reperfusion, a lot of blood coming. We have two organs in the body that are very sensitive to lack of oxygen and excess of oxygen. It's the brain and the kidney. Those are the two critical things. So the major side effect of open heart surgery is kidney. So we know how to treat it. That's one possibility. It is a major heart. I mean, once you have a kidney injury, it is terrible. You have to go into dialysis and things like that. And the life quality is terrible, and the mortality is very high.
Well, tell us what it does in terms of the kidney.
What it does when you have lack of oxygen and then excess of oxygen, it creates havoc in certain cells that are very, very sensitive to this in the kidney and in the brain. And those cells are actually, you start having DNA breakage in the cell. And the cell, when the cell are not functioning well, one of the trick that we have in our body, that cells can go what is called apoptosis. Means cell can commit suicide. Cells in our body, as I'm talking to you now, there are many cells that are dying in my body, basically voluntarily, in altruistic way in order to protect the rest of the body. We have this type of mechanism. It's also cancer, for example. The way how to combat cancer, the ultimate way is cancer cells trying to commit suicide. The problem is that the mechanism of committing suicide in cancer cells, they mutate it, they change it, so they have difficulties to commit suicide. So what we are doing, basically, the trick that we are doing, we shut the mechanism of cell death temporarily. So what happened is that by the time that cells are damaged because of the hypoxia and reperfusion, or lack of oxygen and excess of oxygen, the cells cannot start the death program.
Yes.
Because we actually temporarily shut down this process.
So this must be something you administer before you go to surgery.
No, you can do it right after, because right after the surgery, the blood flow starts, and then this is the most probable. You can do it. Now, you do it temporarily for 48 hours or something like that. So the cells are not dying. But also what we have in our cells, we have a repair mechanism. So by the time this mechanism can operate again, there is no need, because already the repair mechanism repaired the cell. This is the trick.
Very good. So you stall the death mechanism.
We stop temporarily the death mechanism.
So the cell can repair itself.
Repair itself.
And when that comes back,
there's no need to do it. And the body is stupid, because very often we are doing it in order to preserve the body. So we preserve the body, but we lose the kidney. This is in phase three. There are two, but I just want to say that we have two indications. One is open heart surgery, and the other one is delayed graft function. What is this? When you harvest a kidney, you want to do a transplantation on the kidney. So you harvest a kidney from a deceased person here in San Francisco. You put the kidney on ice and you send it to Detroit. And then you actually give it to the recipient.
Right.
So the kidney, again, there is a lack of oxygen. Once in the recipient, blood coming, excess of oxygen, the same thing.
Yes.
And the kidney are then damaged. About 50% of the kidney in this country that are harvested are actually not end up in the recipient. They just have to throw them, because they are damaged. And if they put it there and the person needs a dialysis very soon, it means that the kidney is no longer good.
They'll reject the
kidney.
So
what we have done in phase two, we showed that we can reduce the number of these kidneys that are damaged by close to 50%. So basically, there is a huge need of kidneys. There are 100,000 people per year. There is a queue of more than 100,000 in the United States waiting for kidneys. So if you don't use the kidney, once you have a kidney, it is obviously you cannot just dump it. So we know how to preserve it.
Now, do you treat the kidney that is...
We don't treat the kidney. We give it to the recipient.
Yes.
It's the same like in acute. We give it to the recipient. We know how to deliver it into the kidney, and it shut down temporarily the cell death. And then the repair mechanism come, and by the time that the shutdown is over, there is no need. And that's it. Basically, this is the trick.
How many kidneys are lost right now in the United States?
In the United States, about 20,000 per year.
So 20,000, we might be able to save those.
Or part of it.
Part of it.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it is both indications are unmet medical needs.
Now,
in other words, there is nothing you can do. I mean,
now, you also work in a condition I've not heard of before called sudden vision loss.
Yes, there is a sudden vision loss. There is also sudden hearing loss. It's a devastating disease. In the United States, I think close to 40,000 people per year. I mean, you wake up in the morning, you don't see well. And you go to the physician, and the physician can diagnose it. And then the only solution is, if you Christian go to the church and if you Jewish go to the synagogue, Muslim go to
pray,
basically.
You get religion if you didn't have it before this when this happened.
And this is this is a disease. There are certain cells in the back of the eye, which call retinal ganglion cells, that they are dying very rapidly. And this is very similar to what happened in glaucoma. In glaucoma, they die very, very slowly. It's a slow death, but it's a progressive disease. You can somewhat slow it down because many people with glaucoma, and I'm sure you heard about glaucoma, they have intraocular pressure, a lot of pressure, which make this death even more rapid. So there are eye drops that you can reduce the intraocular pressure. So you slow down the progression, but it's progressed. To do a clinical study, we know how to treat these cells. We know, and what happened in the cells, there is also a mechanism of suicidal at the end. And we know our expertise, one of our expertise, is to play with this mechanism of
cell death. Yeah.
And we know how to take care of it. And this ion, which is ischemic optical neuropathy, it doesn't matter. It's called ion. It's a rare disease, but it's a terrible disease. I don't have to tell you what is to lose the eyesight. It's terrible. So we know how to treat it. We have done it in phase 1-2 study successfully. We went to the FDA. It's unmet medical need. FDA say go immediately to phase 3 because there is nothing there. We do it because you can treat. This is acute situation, so the clinical study are not very long. Once we are successful there, we can go to glaucoma, which is a huge disease, of course, and treat glaucoma. Because there is no treatment for glaucoma. It's simply the only treatment is to slow down the progression.
And again, you're interfering with the cell death so that it can repair itself?
Correct.
Well, Dr. Zora, this is just fantastic. I do hope you'll come back and see us again. We'd appreciate it.
My pleasure. Company is here in San Francisco, partly in San Francisco, partly in Israel. And I think that this sRNA, the world will hear more about it, like everybody knows what is antibody. There's no doubt that it will be even bigger. It's just a question of time.
Thank you.
Okay?
Dr. Daniel Zur is the CEO of Quark Pharmaceuticals. More information is available at quarkpharmaceuticals.com. That's Quark, Q-U-A-R-K, quarkpharmaceuticals.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.